This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at HomeTeam.com.
The wealthiest people in America, they say, what's our allocation to the real estate asset class? Well, we understand the real estate asset class. You understand it better than anybody else. And so how do you think about investing in the thing that you understand in a place where you can put your time and talent behind it?
Well, hello and welcome to another fabulous episode of the Color of Money podcast. I am Julia Lachey and I am joined by two of our co-hosts today. I've got Emmerich Peace. I've got Bo Menkiti. Today we're going to talk about Bo. I was joking before we started about Bo Knows. Some of y'all may be old enough. Some of y'all don't know what I'm talking about, but there used to be a commercial on it. Bo Knows Baseball. Bo Knows. I don't remember all what that man played.
Football.
Yeah, okay. Football. Bo knows all this stuff. And our Bo also knows a whole bunch of stuff. Our Bo knows real estate. Our Bo knows development. Our Bo knows wealth building. And so maybe we can call this episode Bo Knows. And Bo is going to share a little bit with us about what Bo knows. I want you to take us through a journey. People see you, both of you, they see you as this iconic figure in Black real estate. And some people see it as really unattainable, what you've achieved. So I'd love if you could just start us back at where this all began. Walk us through your journey. I did not read your bio on purpose because I kind of want this to like build up, like, you know, started from the bottom. Now we're here. Like, so start from that. Yeah. And take us to the here. And if you're missing out things that I think that people should know, I'll interject. But you are obviously CEO of the Menkiti Group, CEO of Capital Properties. Did I say that right? Keller Williams Capital Properties. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sits on a whole bunch of boards. You know, hold a whole bunch of titles. You've been president of a whole bunch of things. But how? Where did you start from, Bo?
Trying to think of where the right place is to start, right? Like I was born into a family, myself and three sisters in Massachusetts. And my parents were both educators. My mom was an elementary school teacher. And my father was at that time like a junior professor. And so education and learning were like a big part of my childhood. And having three sisters, I guess I got a lot of the extra tasks that my sisters didn't want to do, but I had a great opportunity to learn from them as well as I grew up. You know, my professional career, I played sports. Sports was a big part of my upbringing. And I think a lot of where a lot of my initial fundamental understanding of how you operate as a team came from. And, you know, the thought about discipline, about structure, about being part of a group of people that have a bigger goal and a bigger thing to go after. You know, as a kid, I thought I was going to grow up to play sports and then become a teacher just like my parents. That sort of had been my goal. You know, at some point in college, I realized that I unlikely was going to make a great living playing sports for the rest of my life. I had the opportunity to play, you know, two Division I sports in college. I played ice hockey and baseball. And
Bo knows baseball. Bo knows ice hockey.
So I got to play two sports. But probably a formative experience in that was my freshman year, where I experienced the first real big setback I'd had as an athlete. I went to college thinking I was going to continue being the guy and being a stud on the ice rink and on the baseball field. And I was a big hockey recruit.
Can I stop right there?
Mm-hmm.
You thought you were going to be the hockey goalie. Now, can we just talk about the elephant in the room, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who knew Black people played hockey? Like, can we start there?
When they grow up in Massachusetts, they got to learn something.
Well, there's a secret to that, Julia.
What is it?
Bo, who invented the game of hockey?
Yeah, it's actually, hockey was invented by people of color.
Wow.
Up in the northern provinces of Canada. And actually, it was a group, I guess, kind of native/African-Canadian folks who actually developed the style of hockey that is actually now what we experience as modern hockey.
So, okay, so you reinvigorated that and you as your Black self decided to be the...
And it was part of, you know, to be honest, when you talk about it, not to... I sometimes forget, like as an adult, you know, people always ask me, so why hockey? And like some of my kids are big into hockey. And
yeah.
I think part of hockey for me was this ability to show that we could do things people didn't think we could do. Mm. Yeah. And so, you know, hockey's a sport most people start playing when they're really young. I got introduced to hockey because there was this thing called the Cambridge Skating Club. And it was a tennis club in Cambridge that they would freeze in the winter and it would become this sort of skating club, this private skating club. And we had gone a couple of times with some friends of our family, but we weren't kind of the people who would have membership to this type of a thing. But it was run by this guy and I was homeschooled. And so I used to go over there during the day and help him clean the place up. And he would pay me a little bit of money to sweep, to do things. And so he started letting me and my sisters just come to the club. So I was new to the skating and everything. And so I became a hockey goalie because nobody wanted to be a goalie because they would play hockey in the back and they'd shoot these frozen tennis balls and it hurt. Like, frankly, it hurt. Like being a goalie hurt. You're getting hit with these things. And so nobody wanted to be goalie. So I said, I'll be the goalie. And that was the start of it. When I was 11, I convinced my parents, my mom's from Texas, my dad's from Africa. They'd never heard of hockey. It's not something you did. I convinced them to buy me some hockey equipment, some goalie equipment. And there's a lot of goalie equipment. It's got all these different pieces of equipment.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Isn't it very expensive to play hockey?
It was very expensive. And so I got this like, you know, third hand, you know, 20-year-old hockey equipment.
With a leather helmet. With a leather.
Like now they've got this fancy stuff with colors and everything. Like I had the hockey pads that were just like leather, like stuff with, you know, straw. And so there were a couple of things that got me interested in it. I was athletic, so I was pretty good at it. And I didn't look like someone who should play hockey. I was a 6'2", 250 pounds when I was 13 years old. And so I loved the idea that people would underestimate me or misjudge me. And for me, you know, the big thing that made hockey a part of my life was when I was 13 years old, there was a goalie that played for the Boston Bruins named Reggie Lemelin. And I idolized this guy and he had a hockey camp. And I asked my mom, you know, can I please go to this hockey camp? She's like, well, if you save up your money, you can go. So I go to this hockey camp and it's all these kids that are really into hockey and they've all got great equipment. And I've got this like hand-me-down leftover. I mean, I look like a total scrub, right? And on the second day of hockey camp, which was pretty typical for playing hockey in Boston at that time, some kids in the locker room start making fun of me. And they say, hey, you know, you're a big kid. Why don't you go play one of those Black people sports like basketball or football? You know, you can't play hockey. And you guys are stupid anyways. This like requires intelligence. You're not smart. And I literally, as a 13-year-old kid, I didn't know what to do. I had my hand-me-down equipment. I looked out of place. I didn't know anybody. And all I could think of was, I'm not stupid. Like, I'm not stupid. And so I say to this kid, I'm not dumb. I understand Shakespeare. Because my mom had maybe performed these Shakespeare plays.
Ooh, he got him with that one, Emmerich.
I thought was like the stupidest comeback ever, right? But I stand up on the bench in the hockey locker room. And I start reciting the end of Prospero's The Tempest, the Shakespeare play, which is like, now my powers are all o'erthrown, and what strength I has mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true, I must be here confined by you or sent to Naples, let me not, since I have the dukedom got. Anyways, and while I'm in this moment, one of the coaches walks in. And it just so happens that coach is the hockey coach for a prep school called Roxbury Latin. And he's also the chair of the English department. And he sees a 6'3 kid stand up in the locker room reciting Shakespeare. And he's like, who the hell is this kid? And I happen to be pretty good at hockey and he needed a goalie. So that moment of me not having a good comeback actually changed my life and introduced me to Roxbury Latin, which put me into a very different schooling environment. My parents knew nothing about hockey. They said, oh, this place is a good school and they'll take you. Sure, you got to go there. So a bus and two trains every day later, I went to Roxbury Latin and played hockey there. And that is what really created a lot of academic opportunities for me moving forward. So in some ways, it was this desire to prove people wrong that got me into hockey and kept me focused on it.
And then you ended up going to Harvard.
And then I went to Harvard and I grew up as a kid. Harvard was the university in our backyard. And so if you wanted to go watch a college hockey game, and Harvard was good at hockey. And so to me, like, the dream was you go and you play hockey at Harvard. And I had done really well in high school. I finally got recruited to go play hockey at Harvard. My parents weren't into it. So I wasn't like a big, you know, today, I guess the kids call it like a five-star recruit. I was probably a four-star recruit. Remember, I was a second-tier recruit. And I showed up on campus and I was focused. I worked out all summer and I had an amazing tryout. I thought, like, God, I've proven to these guys, like, I'm the guy. Like, I'm going to start for this team as a freshman. I'm going to take this world by storm. And 3 months into my freshman year, I got cut. And I'll never forget that day. Like, I sat on the banks of the Charles River and cried my eyes out thinking, this thing I've worked on my whole life is over. And what do I do? Like, what should I do? And I had this work study job where I worked for something called dorm crew, cleaning bathrooms as a way to make money. And in some ways, I always say the gift is the curse and the curse is the gift. That period of time where I was cut from the hockey team made me pour myself into this job. And it really is what started my interest in business. And I started to see, oh, this is business. This could be another thing. It's kind of a game. You can figure out how to play it. It requires discipline. It requires teamwork. 30 days later, they ended up kicking the other goalie off the team. And I made it back on the team. And I ended up being part of the team for the next 4 years and playing hockey actually after college a little bit in like a very far reaches of the minor league professionally. But that experience is really where my interest in business started. The time I had that I threw into that organization, I ended up running that organization as a sophomore. And say I went to Harvard and I learned more from the facilities management people at Harvard. There's a gentleman named Robert Wilfries who was in charge of this student-run cleaning organization. He taught me more about leadership, about people, about business, and about life than I learned from any professor at Harvard. And so in many ways, it was that experience when I thought one dream ended that opened up something that became the next chapter of my life.
Wow. Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit hometeam.com to learn more. And then, how did you get into real estate?
So I got into real estate after school. I realized I was going to make it as a professional hockey player. I took a job in the corporate world. I worked for a spinoff of McKinsey & Company doing management consulting. Then I worked for a gentleman who was a very wealthy businessman who hired me as like personal strategist, which was really interesting. Learned a lot about entrepreneurship. But I always had a passion for doing something that impacted like people and communities. I'd done a lot of work with young people when I was in college. And so I became the chief operating officer of an organization called College Summit that worked with low-income high school students in urban and rural areas to apply to college. So first-generation college-going students were trying to navigate the college-going process. And while I was at College Summit, I bought my first house. And I was 24 years old, 25 years old. And I bought a house in a neighborhood called Columbia Heights in Washington, D.C. And I was about a block and a half from a metro stop. And that metro stop was probably three or four stops from, you know, downtown Washington, D.C. But everything around my house was vacant.
Is this back when they used to call, D.C. like Chocolate City?
D.C. Yeah. was a chocolate city, but it was also a city that was still smarting from the riots back in the late 60s. It had not been redeveloped. And so you could be a couple of blocks from the White House and you'd have burnt out sections of Washington, D.C. And in my neighborhood, there was my house, which was like a cheaply renovated house that I'd bought from some flipper. And the lady next to me was named Mrs. Bex, and she'd lived there. She was in her late 70s. She lived there since she was 7 years old. And she was one of these people that just like hold down the neighborhood. And the neighborhood was pretty much gone. Everything else was vacant. And you could walk for two blocks. Every house was vacant except for my house and Mrs. Bex. And I got to know Mrs. Bex. She didn't have any children. And so I would help her with groceries and trash and sit and kind of try and absorb some of her wisdom. And I used to travel a lot for College Summit. I would travel around to all our offices around the country. And I came back in 2003 from having gone around the country, visiting our offices. And I was young and I was kind of cocky. I was like, you know, I got my business skills and I'm using them to change the world. I'm doing the Lord's work. Like, I'm doing it. And I come home after one of these trips, been gone for 2 weeks. And I go over to check on Mrs. Bex and she didn't answer the door. And so I had a key. So I go in to see if she's okay. And she's dead. and she'd passed away. And because nobody checked on her except me, she'd been dead in her home for 2.5 weeks. And that was another sort of pivotal moment in my life. I thought I was changing the world, and I wasn't even like present for the person on the other side of my little flimsy row house wall.
Yeah.
And it made me start to think, like, what am I doing here in the place I live for the people in my community? I'm traveling around the country thinking I'm doing all this stuff, but what's happening right here? We got all these vacant houses. We got people like Miss Bex who were part of this like yesteryear of a community that's being displaced. You know, how do I do that? And so that I said, the answer to me was real estate. I knew nothing about real estate. I said, I'm going to fix up some of these vacant houses and try and bring back this community that Miss Bex used to always tell me about, this thriving community that had once been there. And so I went like any idiot who doesn't know anything about real estate, and I got a real estate license thinking that was going to teach me how to fix up a house. Right. It didn't teach me how to fix up a house. But a little bit later, I had to go affiliate with a brokerage because I didn't want to lose my license. And Long & Foster was the big, Long & Foster is a big brokerage. There's a woman named Holly Worthington who still, she actually works for Compass now, great lady. And she ran the preeminent Long & Foster office in Chevy Chase Circle. And there was this guy, the only black guy I know who did real estate was Dale Madison. And Dale Madison was kind of this, yeah, Dale's a great guy, very sophisticated. And I used to kind of look up to Dale Madison and say, if I ever wanted to do real estate, I would do it like Dale Madison. He just looks like he's got it all together. He works out of the high-end office, but he's still doing his thing. And so I walked my butt into the Chevy Chase Circle office along with Foster and said, hey, I want to be a real estate agent. And Holly said, we don't take part-time people. Like, you know, good luck to you. And I said, no, I'm like really skilled. I run this big organization. Like, I know what I'm doing. Like, no, we don't take part-time people. Well, I've admired Dale Madison. Go down the hall and talk to Dale. If Dale wants to take you on his team, maybe he can work with Dale, but I don't want to talk to you. So I traipse my butt down the hall and find Dale. And Dale's gracious as all can be. He says, I don't really have a team. You know, I'd happy to mentor you or whatever, but I can't put you on a team. I don't have a team for you. So I had to go look for another place. And I found this little Coldwell Banker office on Capitol Hill that would take me. And that's where I started my real estate practice. In my attempt, I was working full-time. So I was a part-time agent. I think this is what people forget. Like, I started as a part-time agent. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I knew a lot of people who needed to buy a house. And I was working a lot. And I didn't really have any success. But a couple of months in, I had made a policy at my work that you had to take half your vacation days. And so I was told, hey, you got to go on vacation for 6 weeks. And I was, okay. I'll go try and find a house to buy. And so I started looking to buy one of the houses in my neighborhood, and I couldn't figure it out. There are all these title issues. I didn't realize they'd all been like put in a land bank, and they weren't even really possible to buy them. But I went looking, trying to buy them, and I was unsuccessful. But a lot of people I knew said they were looking to buy a house. And I said, well, I can help you with that. I got this real estate license and I'm really interested, and I really knew the city. And so I ended up during this vacation getting 6 houses under contract to friends of mine. I said, well, wow, this is really interesting. If you could make a commission on 6 houses in, you know, a couple of months, this could be a really interesting business. And then maybe I'd have enough money to buy these houses I want to buy that I don't have any money to buy them with. And so that's how it started. I started out part-time. My 10th client was the marketing director from one of the places I used to work at. And at her settlement table, Sumi Kim was her name, she sat me down. So we closed on her little one-bedroom condo. And we were sitting there, you know, after the title company gives you the champagne and everything. And she says, you know what? You're going to be really good at this real estate thing. But I know you, and you're not very organized. You need somebody to keep you on track. So I'm going to quit my job, and I'm going to come work in real estate with you. And so Sumi Kim was my first hire. She hired herself. I didn't hire her. She hired herself.
No career.
And so we started a sales team. And, you know, 6 months later, we were the number one rookies of the year in Coldwell Banker, working part-time. And I transitioned to being full-time. And that's sort of how it all started in real estate.
And where does Emmerich fit in this story? Because somewhere along this story, Emmerich plays a part.
Emmerich's in the next chapter. I've been going way slow through the story. But the next chapter was I randomly was working at Coldwell Banker. I met some other young realtors who were thinking of starting. Brandon Green was wanting to start a luxury boutique company. And I had spent some time working with the folks at NRT then, which was the parent company Anywhere now. And they had on a task force to look at urban real estate brokerages. And they never did anything with it. But I learned, hey, brokerages actually kind of need some scale. And so I said to Brandon, who at that time was another company, I said, dude, you can't have a 3-person brokerage. It doesn't make any sense. Why don't we get some more people? We'll get some young people and we'll start a brokerage. So I was having conversations with a bunch of young real estate agents in DC thinking about how can we start an independent brokerage. And I went on vacation to Chicago to see my friend. And I was sitting in the lobby. There's a snowstorm in Chicago. And I was sitting in the lobby of a hotel bar in the lobby. This is some guys I went to college with. And I'm pouring out my heart about real estate is this amazing thing. We can make such a difference. And these ladies from across the bar come over and start talking to us. Say, oh, well, we heard your story. And I'm like, this is kind of embarrassing. Are they hitting on us? What's going on here? And it turns out it was Joanne Curtin from Keller Williams in Roswell, Georgia. And she's like, yo, me and my husband just bought this company, Keller Williams. We're opening up. We're doing an office. It's like, oh, that's interesting. And she mentioned some people I'd heard of. I said, okay, I'll look into it. So I looked into Keller Williams. It turned out that actually someone I knew from Coldwell Banker was at that time the regional director for Keller Williams. And they introduced me and said, well, if you want to do anything, there's one guy who's doing this well. And that was Emmerich. And so Emmerich took me in as a raggedy little know-nothing, wannabe realtor. And they said, you can join Keller Williams, but you got to work out of Emmerich's office. Well, you get this started. And so it was, you know, Preferred Properties took me in like a good little adopted child.
The technical term is incubating, right? Yes. So you incubated.
Technical term is incubating.
Okay.
Like I was a little egg waiting to hatch. And Emmerich kept me warm and made sure the light shined on me till I was able to hatch.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm forever grateful to Unc for, you know, I think when you think about life, there's people who leave a silent wake. And some people leave a silent wake of sadness and broken things. And there's people who leave this nurturing wake that leads to so much. And, you know, I don't think Emmerich gets nearly the credit. He gets a lot of credit for being the guy out in front and putting this thing together. But that comes from years and years of quiet, gentle commitment to other people's growth. And I experienced that and I'm a beneficiary of that. And I am forever grateful for that.
Oh, that's
thank you.
Yeah.
I'm getting ready to cry.
Oh, ever since you've been 60, no, I'm kidding. So you met Emmerich, you were able to incubate in his office, which then led you to be able to
launch a market center, the first market center in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And it was right when the big crash happened and everybody else ran for the hills. And I was quite frankly too new, too young and too dumb to know anything else. So we forged on as if everything was great. And 18 months later, we were the number one real estate office in all of Washington, D.C.
But you also do development, which is what most people know you for, is for developing. Where did development come in to this real estate?
From the beginning, my passion had always been like, I want to own something and I want to fix it up. And so I didn't know much about anything, but I did know that like this brokerage game actually produced cash flow. You got paid commissions. You know, if you did it well, it was relatively consistent. And they were large amounts of money. And I saw everybody around me taking that money and buying a bigger house or buying a fancy car. And that was never really of interest to me. I wanted to sort of own real estate in the community I was in. And so from day one, we took all the money we could make in real estate brokerage and bought a little small little house and fixed it up. And then a year or so in, you know, we bought a small commercial building in Northeast DC. Started to fix that up. And when we opened the market center, we actually opened the market center out of this little teeny old liquor store in Northeast DC. And people say, you're crazy putting a real estate office in a liquor store in Northeast DC. But that was where we started. And that became part of us being part of that community. And over time, we did more and more projects in that community and became known as if you wanted to work in that part of DC, you need to come see us. And that's what really facilitated the acceleration into larger projects and more scale. So yeah, so you think about like starting as a part-time agent. I renovated one house on North Capitol Street. That was my first house, which we bought for $199,000. $199,000. We spent about $40,000 fixing it up. I don't know, we may have sold it for $299 or something. We didn't make hardly any money. But that was the beginning. And you fast forward 20 years, you know, I think people forget that everybody went along that journey. People forget the journey. Uh-huh. You forget the journey sometimes yourself, but people looking from outside definitely forget the journey. And so, yeah. So what started as that one house, you know, now is we've deployed $400 million into real estate in low to moderate income communities in the Mid-Atlantic and up in New England. We have $2 billion worth of large-scale mixed-use development in our pipeline and have become one of the larger minority development companies in the country. And what started out as, you know, part-time real estate agent, we now have Kelwyms Capital Properties, which has about 1,000 real estate agents and Kelwyms franchises from Baltimore down through Fredericksburg, and then own part of and operate, you know, regions of Keller Williams and Maryland and DC and Virginia, West Virginia, and then the Heartland, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, Arkansas, and Nebraska, that represents about another 15,000 real estate agents that collectively, you know, were involved in about just under 2% of the home sales in the U.S. Wow. And so it's long point A to point B.
Yeah.
Happens because a lot of other people are on that journey.
Sure.
But it doesn't happen because Bo knows. It happens because at least Bo knew enough to know that Bo didn't know. And Bo had the opportunity to travel alongside some really amazing people in that journey.
So you talk about, that's your career journey, right?
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, of course, you made a little money, which would bring us to a conversation of, yeah, a little bit, conversation of wealth, right? Which is what mm-hmm. this podcast is about. It's helping people earn more, learn more, and build wealth. Because you could have these opportunities and you could meet these wonderful people along the journey and you could do all of these things, but how do you even know what to do with your money? How do you know what builds wealth? How do you even know what wealth is? Tell me a little bit about the wealth journey. And because you, I was saying before we started this episode, I stumbled upon a class in command. It was a wealth building class and it was you. And I don't remember if it was a whiteboard, if you were on the computer, but it was some slides. Yeah, some slides you had teaching a wealth building class. So how do you go from all of those things to, I would call it, even mastering wealth?
I'll share with you what I call Bo's wealth building perspective, which came out of further down the line, Gary Keller challenged me to put what I've learned about wealth building on one page. And so I made this model called the wealth building perspective, which I'll share with you. And partly it was probably because I grew up in New England and I was a poor kid.
No, you were a broke kid. You weren't a poor kid. is a state of mind. Broke okay. is a state of bank account.
Correct. I did not have a lot of resources. I had a rich mind, but a poor ass life. Okay. But I had lived just fine running a nonprofit and making the salary that I made from that nonprofit. And so when I got into real estate and all this money started flying around, I made a commitment. And I was lucky enough a couple of years into that, when I got married and found a partner, I was able to convince my partner of this, which was harder than convincing myself, I will say, that we should live off of our salary. I should live off of my salary. So I continued to pay myself the same amount of money I made before I got into real estate for the first 9 years I was in real estate. So that amount, you know, was about maybe a quarter, sometimes a fifth of what I was making in commissions and other earnings in the early parts of real estate. And because one of the natures of money is that it compounds, a lot of the wealth building success was setting aside money early in the journey to invest in things that later grew. And that is the first bucket in my mind of the wealth building perspective. Mm-hmm. And I call that the create bucket. And in the create bucket, to actually build wealth, you got to start by creating some dollars. You have to have free dollars, not money that you made. Like, making money is not wealth. You have to have money left over after you pay for your life. And so the easy way to do that when you're starting is to control your life, because there's only so much money you can make. And so I talk about this create bucket. In the create bucket, we trade time and talent for money. We can get a little more skilled and we can work a little harder and we can make more money. But those are the only levers we have in that bucket. We are selling our time and our talent for money. And quite frankly, being a commissioned salesperson, that's what you're doing. You're selling your time and your talent for money. And it's one of the best ways to create income. It's one of the worst ways to create wealth. And so early on, I was able to create income. And because I capped my lifestyle at my prior income and had a new income, I was able to create investable cash. You know, that dry powder that you could actually put into something. And early on, I invested in two things. I invested in a Kelwyms Market Center, and later a bunch of other Kellens Market Centers. And I invested in real estate assets in emerging neighborhoods. And I like to talk about it as I just got back last night. Actually, just took a red eye last night to be back for my 15-year-old's birthday morning. But I was out on the West Coast at a capital markets conference with a bunch of these bigwig investment people. And I summed up my investment strategy there when they asked me about it to speak on this panel the same way I'd tell it to you. It was find a place, a city, with strong macroeconomic and demographic fundamentals. I'll make that a lot simpler. That just means a place where there are jobs and people want to move to. So it's growing in population and it's growing in jobs. And across America, there's a number of cities. Some of them are your major cities you know about. Some are some second-tier cities, which are growing quickly. And in those cities, there's going to be a neighborhood that I like to say is on the other side of perception. And we know those neighborhoods all too well because we grew up in them. Most of our friends and folks like us live in them.
All right.
And they usually were divided from the rest of the community intentionally through some psychological or physical barrier. We say the other side of the tracks.
Right.
But the tracks were a man-made thing designed to separate.
And the highway was a man-made thing.
And if you look at the highway infrastructure built in the 50s and 60s in America, it was intentionally took Black communities' real estate by eminent domain and created separating factors to segregate neighborhoods. And so you can lament it in the history books. I learned all about it when I was a sociology major, but I realized that you could actually harness that as an investment strategy. So our strategy has been, you go on the other side of perception, not way on the other side, just on the other side of perception, just on the other side of the tracks, in a place where the place is growing. And when there's general economic development activity and something's growing, eventually economics trump perception. And what happens is it would be almost like if I had this water, I had this water and I spilt it on the table. It grows. I call it ink blot growth. It just kind of spreads. But imagine that there was all of a sudden, I had this stapler and I took the stapler and I put the stapler there. The water is going to stop at the stapler. But if there's more water coming, eventually it's going to pool up and it's going to overflow the stapler and go on the other side of the stapler. And so our goal was simply to find the place where the water pooled and was eventually going to overflow. And people are usually lamenting what happens when it overflows. But if you do any sort of research, you can tell where that's going to happen. And quite frankly, our community is better positioned than anybody else to understand that and to go navigate those neighborhoods. The problem is we usually don't own our real estate. And so when that wave comes, we lose control of the thing that's now nicer. And we get pushed out and we have to move somewhere else. So the strategy for me was always, can we go early? Can we engage those communities to have more homeownership, to have more small businesses engaged, succeeding, owning their business, owning their potentially their location, so that when that inevitable economic development wave comes, we're prepared to benefit from that rather than be hurt by it. So that was the history of it. So I started in Northeast DC just because that's where I was living. I lived in the place where it was vacant and nobody wanted to go. So I bought where I could buy. And over time, I saw the city just move eastward. We're almost connected now out to the bucolic hills where Emmerich is. But the whole city just kept moving eastward. And we went where people didn't want to go, improve buildings and invest in things people didn't want to invest in. And the reason I could do that was because I had the crate. You had the dry powder from creating, which leads you to the second pillar, right? Which is to multiply.
Well, wait, how many are there? Because we only have 5 minutes. How many pillars are there?
There's three.
Okay, let's hear about the second pillar.
Second pillar is multiply. And that's where you trade time, talent, and money for money.
Yeah.
So this is where you go put your money behind yourself. You take a risk. And so many people say, I want to own a business. I want to do this. I want to be a developer. But you're not really a business owner or a developer unless you have your own capital at risk. So you have to have capital to take a risk. And instead of taking a risk and investing in somebody else, you actually put it behind yourself. You bet on yourself. You bet on your time and your talent, and you go make it happen. And that is the best way to create wealth, okay? I call that the multiply space.
That sounds like entrepreneurship, yes?
It's totally entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
The third bucket is protect and grow. And that's where you trade money for money. This is where your stock portfolio grows. This is where your investments compound. This is where money makes more money. And the problem, and I just sum this up because I know Julie's got me on the clock. Sum it up is that in America, we tell people to play in that first space, to trade their time and talent for money. This is the American story. And then we say, if you want to have a retirement, go give your investment manager some money, go get a 401k, do something in the money for money space. And the reality is, as I grew up broke, not poor, as Emmerich said, I was never going to make enough money in my lifetime that I could trade money for money and catch up to the people that have had a 300-year head start.
Absolutely.
So I had to go take my money and take a risk and play in the multiply space, because that's the only way I could fundamentally change the general wealth legacy, you know, the generational wealth of my family. So I say to people that you got to master the create space so that you have dry powder. You need to understand the protect and grow, the money for money space, because that's like the PhD stuff, and you need that for stability. But you actually change things in the multiply space. And as realtors, as people in real estate professionals, as developers, as realtors, we have this tremendous opportunity to sit in this asset class that's the heart of America. Like, I was just out there talking to these people, and the wealthiest people in America, they say, what's our allocation to the real estate asset class? Well, we understand the real estate asset class. You understand it better than anybody else. And so how do you think about investing in the thing that you understand in a place where you can put your time and talent behind it so that you can multiply that money you've created so that someday you can live off the money for money protected and grow space?
That, in fact, was a masterclass on wealth building. Yeah, the three buckets. And so I know people are listening and they're like, where do I learn more about this three bucket philosophy? How do I learn more about this wealth building continuum? That's your word I learned from you, Bo. How do they get this information? Because clearly, Bo knows.
We've spent some time putting this together. It's a class. I taught it pretty widely in KW. I'd love to do more of it. And I know that we've talked about putting this together for inside of the Empower Network and inside of KWBRN as potentially something that we could bring back and pull together some of the folks on this podcast and others. So I would be happy to do that. I look forward to that. You can always reach out to me for when the next class is coming up, but I would love to programmatically put something together along with our Color of Money family to continue to take this to the next level, because Bo only knows a piece and all of you know something. And when we put all that knowledge together, we can get a whole bunch more.
I've been unusually quiet.
Yes, you have.
I just wanted it to flow, because I know when Bo goes, he goes. And I didn't want to interrupt the flow. But what I want everybody to understand is there's a lesson. There's a lesson to be taught. There's a lesson to be learned. In that space, we just have to think about that idea of critical, I call it critical mass, amassing enough money so that your money can make money. Mm-hmm. And what's that? You know, we all have a different place of whatever we want to do in our life. And we just have to stick to that plan and just look at those three steps that Bo talked about. But the key, if you can't, it's hard to get in the game when you don't have enough money to be in the game. And that's what critical mass is about. And critical mass just means that you have enough money to make your money make money.
That's good. Thank you. Bo, what's the one thing you want the audience to leave with today?
One thing I'd have you leave with is that money and wealth, like success and a lot of other things, are not linear. They're geometric. And what that means is that when you put in more effort and you work a little harder, you don't get an equal return. And the biggest myth in our world, in our immediate gratification economy, is that if I work a little harder and I do a little more, I better get more immediately or else I don't do it. And the reality is that the way you build wealth is time on task over time, investment of money over time. And what happens is it starts to grow exponentially. So for the first 9 years of being in business, opening Market Center, buying properties, I didn't make a lot of money. So much so that we talked about quitting this entire business. And in the next year, between years 9 and 10, we made as much money as we made in years 1 to 9. And in years 11 and 12, we made 4 times as much money as we made in years 1 through 10. And it grew massively exponentially. But if we'd given up on that journey earlier because we didn't quite get the return, so you got to know you're on the right path. But you got to stay the course because it is definitely gradually than suddenly.
There it is. I like that. Thank you, Bo. That is Bo's story. Bo does, in fact, know real estate development and wealth building. And we hope you all will continue to tune in to hear more about what Bo knows. Till next time, friends. Thank you for tuning into the Color of Money podcast. We will see you next week. Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not KWRI and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.